Light Source is available free of charge through studiolighting.net. You can support Light Source by visiting supportlightsource.com. There you can donate through the tip jar, purchase a lighting DVD, get a discount on website hosting through squarespace.com, or you can visit our affiliate links for Adorama or amazon.com, where you can shop for camera gear or photography books, and a portion of those proceeds will help support Light Source.
Hey, this is Martin Perhoda. I'm an advertising photographer from Vancouver, Canada, and you guys are listening to Light Source.
And welcome to episode 83 of Light Source, the official podcast of StudioLighting.net, the website introducing photographers to portrait and studio lighting equipment and techniques. I'm Bill Crawford, publisher.
And I'm Ed Hidden, exclusive photographer with iStockPhoto.com. On today's episode, we have two guests. Our main interview, we have Martin Perhoda. He is a commercial photographer joining us on the phone from Bombay on the other side of the world. So the Skype connection is what it is a little sketchy, but if you can put the quality aside, there's just a lot of good information in this interview. So it's well worth sticking around for.
Absolutely. And we also have a little special announcement that we're going to make in a few minutes about a contest that we're going to be having. So that's exciting. Haven't done that for a while.
Yeah, we haven't done that for a while. Before we do get into that, being that I've been in the world of video for the last 2 or 3 months,
right?
I haven't done anything but. There's two cool announcements for 5D Mark II users. One of them, it's a new firmware update for the 5D Mark II that allows you to control full aperture control while in video mode. So that is big news. A lot of guys have been asking for that. And Canon's definitely listening to what people are saying, and they're trying to get as many features as they can out there as people are using this more and more, listening to some of the video guys that I've been listening to. You know, a lot of indie filmmakers are really excited about digital SLRs, and
that's cool.
You know, there's a lot of companies that are making big stuff out there for them. So yeah.
Even Jeremy Coart just published his first music video that he did entirely with that camera. So
that's really cool. Myself, I'm kind of leaning towards the new Rebel that just came out, the T1. Actually,
right.
It's almost hitting, I think, towards the middle of next month, I think, is when it's supposed to be hitting my stores. I'm getting really close to getting that as a backup to my 5D and being able to shoot video too. So
excellent.
I shot a wedding recently and used my old 10D as a backup, and I really enjoyed shooting with two cameras.
That is cool.
It was really cool. I kind of like doing that.
That's fun. You mentioned two things with the Mark D. What's the other one?
There is a new iPhone app.
Oh, okay.
For the cameras that have the live view and stuff, if you attach the 5D to a notebook and you use the Wi-Fi connection with the notebook and your iPhone, you can remotely control the 5D Mark II with your iPhone.
That's pretty neat. I have to admit, that's pretty darn awesome.
Yeah, and you figure, I didn't price what the app is. I think that most of them are fairly inexpensive, but you know, it's a lot cheaper than spending $1,000 on a Wi-Fi adapter for your camera.
No doubt. And being that that's a Canon-only deal for now, I should also mention that there was a great article which actually surfaced in Flickr amongst Strobus users, where a young gentleman was able to figure out how to modify a Wi-Fi USB adapter to work with the Nikon as a Wi-Fi tethering situation for under $50.
Oh, so no, that's just way cool.
That is way cool. So I'll put a link to that as well. So we'll keep the Canon guys happy and the Nikon guys happy.
Well, you'll have to try the Nikon one and tell us how it works.
I'm really tempted. There's a little bit of soldering involved, so I might need your help.
Okay, well, we can do that. Well, we're still talking about products. You were telling me about something David Tejada is doing.
Oh, yeah. I was talking a little bit with David Tejada, and he mentioned, and it's also on his blog, but a friend of his has actually designed a really interesting little piece of aluminum, which it's actually a bracket. It's a square, and it's called a four square because it mounts up to four portable flashes and allows them to all be pointed into, say, a softbox or an umbrella. So there's places for a light stand to be mounted and also places for umbrella shafts to be screwed in. It's really a pretty cool looking mount for that sort of thing. And as I guess as portable flashes are getting more and more popular, this is a piece of equipment that I think would make Joe McNally proud.
I think it would probably get away from him having to bungee so many
right.
of his devices onto a light stand. it's really cool. I mean, the only downsides I see to a device like this is that you have to have four flash guns.
Right. But if you're looking for a way to leverage the flashes that you already have and get yourself into a larger light source with a little more power, say, for balancing with daylight, this is definitely something to check out. So I'll put a link in to David's blog about that. And also, speaking of David Tejada, since we've had David on the show, I thought some of our listeners might also be interested in the fact that David is speaking at an event in Denver on June 6th. So he's going to be giving sort of a mini version of his workshop for small flashes, which I think would be well worth checking out. So we'll put a link to that event as well.
Oh, cool. While we're talking about these small flashes and things like that, we should probably bring on our special guest.
Sounds great.
We have James Madeline with Enlight Photo. He is the inventor of the Orbis Ring Flash. Thanks for joining us, James.
Hey, guys. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, thanks. Now, we've talked about the Orbis Ring Flash on the show before, but if you could tell our audience a little brief explanation in your words what it is and what it does, that'll help get people acquainted with it.
Sure. It was kind of an interesting story. I was working as a newspaper and magazine photographer, and I was obviously carrying around all of my photography equipment, having to do sometimes sort of 8 to 10 portraits a day, and was really looking at ways that I could make better use of the equipment I was carrying around with me, the sort of the small flashes that I was using a lot. I'm a self-taught photographer, so I was trying to learn as much as I possibly could about different lighting techniques and that kind of thing. And so I got to experimenting with the whole idea of making your own ring flash using sort of DIY techniques. And basically, as you might know, a ring flash is a studio photographer's lighting tool. Traditionally, they're very big, bulky, and very expensive, but they give you this beautiful, shadowless quality of light because, of course, they bathe your subject in light because they surround the lens with light. And so what I basically did to start with is I built my own version of one of these that I could push my flash into. And I instantly found the results were really cool, and my subjects did as well. The people whose portraits I were taking absolutely loved their photos. But of course, it wasn't a really good look, particularly to be walking around as a pro photographer with this thing hanging off my camera made of duct tape and tin foil, aside from the fact that it kind of fell apart very quickly. And you know, that was the moment that I thought to myself, this is amazing, I'd really want to own one of these, but I can't. And that's what set the idea in motion. So the Orbis Ring Flash is basically that. It's a lighting tool that turns the harsh light from your SLR flash gun into beautiful shadowless light.
Well, now, one of the things that distinguishes this from, say, the diffusers that are on the market that just slide down over your flash is this ring flash is much like the traditional ring flash that you discussed used in the studio, where it surrounds the lens axis with light, correct?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. We've designed the Orbis to actually work with off-camera flash. So that's to say your flash doesn't sit in the hot shoe when you're using the Orbis. And the reason that we did that was two main reasons, really. One was that we wanted it to fit as many different kinds of flashes and lens combinations as possible. Because, you know, as a photographer, first and foremost, I really hate it when you buy a piece of equipment and when you upgrade your camera or your lens or your flash, you suddenly find that all the gear you've got suddenly doesn't fit. So that was one reason. Another reason was that the hot shoe connection between flash guns and cameras is actually quite fragile. It's designed to be like that, so that obviously you're not putting at risk the body of your camera or your flash, and the Orbis gets around that by not relying on that connection. And the third thing was, by working off camera, the Orbis doesn't obstruct any of those sensors in front of your flash, like that you use for focus assist and depending on your flash system, some of the other functions as well.
That's great. So you could actually remove it from the axis of the lens if you wanted to and get a similar look from a different angle.
That's a really interesting point that you've just come across there. That's one of the things that we're starting to get into with some of the videos that we put out on YouTube, is a sort of an advanced use. Exactly as you just said, you can actually move the Orbis off to one side handheld, or you can even put it on a light stand. And what it does then is, rather than giving you the ring flash effect, it still is making your light source considerably larger than it normally would be if you were just photographing with a bare flash gun, which of course gives you softer shadows and all sorts of things that do wonders to your portrait subjects, effectively making it like a micro softbox or even a little beauty dish.
That's great.
Nice. The other thing too, with it not being tethered to it, it also fits so many different lenses and all kinds of different things that you don't have to worry about a specific mount that, you know, has to have a bunch of adjustability too.
That was one of my driving reasons behind designing it that way, because, as I said, you know, I was such at the time, you know, very busy photographer, as a lot of people are, whether you're a pro or an amateur, you know, you don't want to spend, you know, 15, 20 minutes setting up your gear. You just want to get down to it and shoot. And so, you know, that's why we designed a handheld, so you can shoot really nice and loose with that. We are working on a fitting kit in case, you know, for photographers who want to use it for sort of longer, extended periods of time. But, you know, that's one of the great things. You can bring it up. You can take a few photos with it. You can change your lens. You don't need to change any mountings or anything like that. It just makes it really sort of fast and smooth to shoot, to work with.
We actually demoed one of the units, and James, I want to thank you for letting us do that for a while. And what surprised me was it's very light. It's not a piece of equipment that is really obtrusive or even hard to throw in your gear bag, which was very nice. Well, the other thing that I wanted to mention in our comparison to other ring flashes that we've used is we've run into cases where sometimes it's difficult to focus and so forth if you have a large ring flash that's attached in such a way to your camera that you can't get your hands in there. I didn't find that to be the case with the Orbis at all. It was easy to slide it on and off, again, because it wasn't attached to anything. So that was a...
Interestingly enough, one of the things, as you say, it is kind of lightweight. I mean, it comes in at 650-odd grams or whatever, so you don't feel like you've got this big chunk in your hands. And you can also, of course, when you hold it up to the camera, you normally hold your SLR camera or whichever system you're using with two hands to really steady it. You can, of course, rest a lot of the weight of the camera system inside the lens tunnel of the Orbis, so you're effectively still taking weight in both hands. And, of course, your autofocus system still works as usual.
That's excellent. I think it's also because of the amount of money that it actually costs is so much less than what you would expect to pay for a traditional ring flash. It's a great way to experiment with a look that maybe a photographer would normally not get a chance to experiment with.
Totally. I mean, that was one of my ideas, was that it meant that I could very quickly, if I wanted to take a portrait of someone, I could get a natural light photo of them, get a side lit photo using an off-camera flash, bouncing it off somewhere, put the Orbis on my flash, get a ring flash photo, and in less time than it would generally take you to set up a single piece of studio equipment, I could get three completely different looks, which obviously, when I was a working photographer, was great because I had the edge on my competitors, because my client, generally a magazine or a newspaper editor, would get three totally different looks really quickly. Mm. And hey, you know, when I'm shooting my family or just, you know, out and about and money's got nothing to do with it, it gives you that really cool look that looks like you've set up this big piece of studio equipment in your front room to take a photo of your toddler or your baby, when in fact, of course, all you've done is quickly pop your Orbis on the flash and, you know, grab a few frames, which is
right.
Cool.
Well, now, should folks be concerned that their flash may not be powerful enough, or are there different models or brands that you recommend more than others?
Not really. I mean, the Orbis does, of course, use some of the flash's output in redirecting the light. So if you're really focused, if you're what I call like a really technical user, and you're really focused on lighting up, you know, the other side of the street or like a big set or a big setup, then you, admittedly, you're going to start getting to the stretching limits of what's possible with an Orbis. And but that said, you know, for basically every portrait application, you know, out to sort of good 4 or 5 meters away, pretty much every flash we've tested with the Orbis is more than powerful enough to get really nice exposures.
Excellent.
Nice.
And of course, that's the cool thing, because unless you're using something like a Pocket Wizard system where the flash isn't talking to the camera to compare your metering or, you know, to use a technical term, your TTL information, if you're using a camera system like, you know, the Nikon CLS system or an off-camera cord or anything like that, you know, the camera and the flash will work out the metering for you, which obviously is just one of the other cool things about it.
James, I want to thank you for the excellent work that you did in designing and getting this product in production. Is it easy for folks to get their hands on Orbis Ring Flash?
Yeah, really easy. We actually put a lot of work into that before we launched. So there are a number of ways you can get them. You can buy them direct from our website, which is www.orbisflash.com. And then depending on where you are in the world, we've also got a network of affiliated dealers and distributors around the world that if you go to our website, you can find a link on the Buy Now page to dealers and distributors. So we've got a distributor in the US. We're on sale in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Germany, Sweden, yeah, and you can find all of that information online. But the cool thing is, if you buy direct from us, we ship it from a warehouse that's near to wherever you are.
Oh,
so
great.
You don't pay lots on shipping. You know, if you're in the US, for example, we ship FedEx 2 days to anywhere in the US.
Oh, excellent.
Another thing that we have you on for is you wanted to mention about a contest that we're going to be having.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sort of excited to be able to announce in conjunction with the Light Source and StudioLighting.net that we're running an Orbis-inspired photography competition. The prize is going to be Orbis Ring Flash, and we'll probably throw in some other goodies as well that we're working on at the moment. And also the chance to have five of the winners' Orbis photos showcased on orbisflash.com.
Excellent. Well, that's very generous and exciting. We'll make sure that the details for the contest are on the studiolighting.net website, along with the show notes for this podcast episode. And we'll also be using the Flickr Light Source group to collect photos. So there'll be some information about the contest there as well.
We'll get the word out, as you said, there on Flickr. And also we'll post it to orbisflash.com and our blog as well, with sort of the competition rules and the brief, because that's the cool thing. We're going to give people a bit of an exciting brief. It's nice and broad, so you can interpret it in all sorts of different ways, but you're going to have to interpret a brief, which is going to require a little bit of thought, let their creativity loose. And so here goes. Here's the brief. Thanks to the internet and the digital camera, our traditional notion of the photographer will never be the same. Personal celebrity, urban surveillance, and other influences have fundamentally changed the role the photographer plays in our lives. And that's it. So competition entries will interpret and explore that theme explicitly or otherwise. When you read it, when we post it online, you'll be able to see that actually it still leaves it open to considerable interpretation. So it's going to be a lot of fun to see what people come up with.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to do this with you guys, and I think a lot of our listeners will be excited as well.
Great.
If folks want more information about the Orbis Flash or are interested in reading about your frequently asked questions and a lot of the great video and samples that you have in your gallery and your website, you can get to that at orbisflash.com. Thanks for joining us, James.
It's been a pleasure, guys. Look forward to judging the contest.
We're excited about that contest, and make sure you head on over to studiolighting.net to get more information about the rules and so forth and what we're actually after for submissions.
And maybe get yourself an Orbis Ring Flash. In the meantime, you can check out this interview with Martin Prochota and follow along with him on his website, martinprochota.com. That's P-R-I-H-O-D-A. Hope you guys enjoy the show. And on this edition of The Light Source, we have with us this evening Martin Prochota. Martin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Great to be here.
Yeah. Now, you get the award so far for the longest distance interview that we've done. You're calling us right now from where?
I'm calling you from Bombay, which is, of course, in India.
What's going on in Bombay? I see you're blogging a bit about your travels over there.
Yeah, actually, I'm having a really interesting time. What's been happening is that my fiance is a yoga instructor back in Canada, and we sort of made this decision that we were going to change things up a little bit, and she wants to come here and study. As you know, India is kind of the hotbed of yoga philosophy and whatnot, so this was a good opportunity for her. And I was in India 10 years ago, and memories of India were that it was perhaps the most photogenic country that I'd ever visited in my life, so I was quite anxious to get back. My intention was a little bit different this time than the last time I was here. I'm here definitely pursuing, you know, contacts with advertising agencies. And I mean, as you guys may know, this city has an incredible media infrastructure. There's a lot going on. And another sort of reason I decided to come here and check it out is that the recession hasn't affected India as much as it has back home.
Oh, wow.
Here, the economy is seeing a slowdown, but there's still a lot going on here. I mean, these guys produce movies like it's still not a style. You know, there's always commercial shoots going on. There's a new magazine popping up every month. So I was kind of like, Bombay, it's pretty far.
Yeah,
but
right.
It sounds exciting. And I like to change things every now and again. And I just had this feeling that my particular style of photography would sort of be appreciated over here. And so far, it's been received quite well. I've been here 2 months, and it's been a very humbling experience because, you know, I have all my contacts back home and my client base, and you know, there was sort of a steady stream of work. But here it's been getting out and hitting the pavement and meeting with ad agencies and meeting with magazines and whatnot. So hitting the pavement in Bombay is a little bit different than hitting the pavement back home. Because you're dodging rickshaws and cows and crap on the street, and it's different. And it's hot. It's like 40 degrees. So just by the time you get to your meeting, you start soaking in sweat.
Oh, no.
But if you can handle that, then it's a really exciting city.
Are you finding the culture and the attitude of folks to be kind of welcoming to you, friendly and so forth?
Yeah, it has been, actually. Part of that reason is they have a real appreciation of Western ideas. You know, India in the last 10 years has just gone through a huge boom cycle. It's a country with a billion people, and the middle class here is growing at an exponential rate. So I think that it's in part what's fueling the need for advertising. And it's also why they're a little bit more protected from the global recession, is because they have such a huge population base that's kind of coming up, especially the middle class. So it's a little bit more self-sustained. It's funny because I'll call up an ad agency and I'll be like, hey, my name is Mark Rahoda. I'm an advertising photographer and I'd love to come and show you my portfolio. And I'll usually have a meeting within 3 hours.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah, they're just like, come down now. And sometimes it's just to chat and to meet, but other times it's like, they're really interested in seeing what's going on in the West, and they're a very welcoming culture. I've really had a good time here. So there's a lot of things that are very different in the West. The society here is very marginalized. There's a lot of poverty. But from a photographer's point of view, there's such a stark contrast here between wealth and poverty that it just makes for the most fascinating photographs. There's a photograph around every corner in India.
Well, some of your images are just unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's been interesting because it's taken on more of a photojournalistic slant. Just me with a camera and a lens on the street, it's been great. Not a lot of studio lighting, not a lot of carrying around heavy equipment as I usually do back home.
Right.
It's allowed me to get back to basics and just the love of photography and love of capturing a good image.
That's exciting.
So, yeah.
Now, when you're showing your portfolio to folks in Bombay, what kind of images are getting the most attention?
Well, there's this huge fashion scene here. So anything I've done with fashion usually gets a lot of attention. And, it's a culture, and their media and their photography and even their films tend to be hyper-real. So any of my work that's got the sort of crazy rim lighting and the key shifted ambient sky or the dramatic clouds, they like that kind of stuff a lot. They think it's really neat. And I think as well, too, is the way they use equipment here is a little bit different. I found back home, the equipment and rental houses are in such abundance. Like, it's really easy to go out and rent a 7B pack with a couple of heads and you go out and shoot. Whereas here, it's different. The equipment isn't as abundant. You really have to search around for it. And then you got to kind of hobble it together. And a lot of the photographers here own their own equipment. So it's been really tricky trying to find studios and rental houses and that kind of thing. The infrastructure just isn't there the same way. And they shoot a lot in studio here. That's why I think they don't do a lot of outdoor. I mean, they do, but it's not as pronounced, I would say.
So with equipment, then, do you find, though, that the photographers that are in the commercial market there, are they, for the most part, up to par in terms of equipment and everything like that?
Yeah, there are. And, I've only been here 2 months, so it's been a huge research project. And the thing I'm finding with India is that back home, you just Google a rental house and, whatever name pops up and you just say, call up and say, I need to book this equipment. But here, there's a lot more done by word of mouth. You can find a producer to work with and you tell them what you need and then they can sort of buy all the gear and whatnot. But they're shooting with some pro photo gear as far as cameras, these digital backs. You just need to kind of go out and search for it.
Excellent.
And as a Westerner coming here, not knowing anything about that, that was definitely a challenge. The photographers told me here, it's tougher to find equipment.
That's an adventure.
Which I was surprised at because it is an adventure. Everything here is an adventure. I step out of my door and it's not like you're going into battle.
Right.
It's like you're going on an adventure, just you and your camera and something always happens or there's so many people here, right? And there's such a crazy frenetic energy to the city.
That's cool stuff.
But my portfolio has been well received. I've really been happy with that. And, there's a few things going on here that are sort of making the slowdown as well, just a little bit more pronounced. I mean, India's just going through an election right now. They also have the IPL, which is a big cricket Premier League, so that the whole thing kind of shuts down for cricket over here.
Wow.
And then of course, in a few months, the monsoon is coming. So when the monsoon comes, things tend to slow down a little bit too. I can't wait to photograph the monsoon.
Right.
What that's going to look like.
Yeah, just a big blur.
In my camera, but... Apparently, it's just like, the city gets flooded and it's just, I think the images from that alone will be incredible.
Wow.
3 feet of water coming up through the streets.
Wow.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of your work from stateside.
Okay.
And actually kind of tying a little bit back into the whole Bombay thing. On your website,
sure.
It's martinperhoda.com. For those following along at home, you have a really cool portfolio section and they have some different sections. And one of them that's really caught my eye is the yoga section. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind doing this. I mean, I know that you have a personal connection with yoga here, but describe the series to the audience for people.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I practice yoga myself. I find it a great sort of grounding physical exercise, as well as a fantastic sort of way to connect with the body and this, you know, the spiritual side. And also a lot of my friends back home in Vancouver, I'm actually Canadian stateside. A lot of my friends are yogis, they practice yoga. So I inevitably had this connection. I find it's a very photogenic physical exercise and it would give me a lot of opportunity to get my lights out there. And there's a lot of yoga photography out there. I don't find a lot of it that great. So I just kind of wanted to do something different. And some of these poses are so incredible.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you light them right or put them in a certain setting, it just tells an amazing story. And of course, I love to play with lights. I love the shifty ambient sky. I love the drama that that creates. So it just creates a very cinematic, sort of inspired, hyper-real look, which I love, which I can get into why I like that from my past a little bit.
I think some of the things that really strike me about the series that I really liked is when I think of yoga photography, I think of like either, you know, bamboo floors or, you know, like a really interesting studio. I don't picture a model in jeans with Chuck Taylors standing alongside some urban building,
right,
or in a boxing ring or things like it's the whole juxtaposition of like this, you know, this
yeah, there's the whole contrast around it. I love to throw contrast into the photography. I think that's what makes a great photograph, is something that makes you look at it and go, oh, there's a story there. And nothing creates a story like drama and conflict. I mean, that is the essence of story, is contrast and conflict. So if you can create something like that, that's like, whoa, that's different. You know, yeah, like, you know, the whole Yoga Fight Club series I did, you know, raised a few eyebrows because it's like, you know, this yoga is supposed to be the spiritual practice, yet they're all cut up and bruised and bleeding.
Oh, right.
I just thought that was the neatest contrast, because you can look at that in a couple different ways. It's like, you know, the yoga, say, you know, there's a part of your life where you're going through maybe something rough, you know, a rough patch in your life, and you know, internally you feel like that you're bruised and bleeding and beat up, and then you have this yoga practice that helps ground you. So it's more like it was created that inner conflict might be outwardly shown, you know, through like a physical violence or a physical,
sure,
attribute. I just don't think, you know, yeah, you're right. A lot of yoga photography is, you know, people dressed in white meditating on in a long bamboo floor. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something different and tell a story and, you know, see if you could really capture that juxtaposition and that contrast.
These are terrific. Next time we take a photo walk out, I want to see you do the thing with the foot on the tree trunk there.
See.
Oh yeah.
I think
yeah,
you could pull that off.
I think I could do that, Bill. Okay.
You think you can do that? Huh?
I think I can do that.
Well, we'll have to see.
Well, with enough practice, you guys would be surprised what you can pull off. I can talk a little bit too about how this sort of style came about for me.
I'd love to hear that.
My first love and my first sort of dream, and still is to direct, and actually to direct, you know, feature films. I love storytelling, and I went to film school, and after film school, I worked as a telephony assistant. It was when they shoot film on movie sets, you know, like 35mm motion picture film. The sound is recorded separately from the actual film, and the reason they have a slate, you know, when they go like take three, and they have the clapper, they shoot the audio to the film. So my job was, I was a sound syncer, basically. So I would sync the audio. At that time, it was a DAT tape or a 4/4-inch Niagara. I would sync the visual cue with the sound of the clap on the tape.
Okay.
And so basically, I was working on dailies. So I would see all the rough dailies that production had shot. And the benefit of this was that the director and the director of photography would always come in and they would discuss the shots, they would discuss the lighting, they would discuss, you know, what they could do differently. And so I was always listening. You know, I was a young kid, I was in my early 20s, and I was always listening to, you know, talking about the lighting that they would do, and, you know, butterfly lighting and all this kind of different lighting stuff. And also got to see how the colorist, and he's the guy that manipulates the image, how he got to actually play with the colors and the color balance. And I began to learn about, you know, crunching the blacks and what a dynamic range was and what you could do. So that eventually when I finished that job, I made a few short films and I got into some commercial work. And then when eventually photography hit me, and then when it hit like a ton of bricks, I kind of had all this love of filmmaking and also a post-production background, because I worked as an editor as well for time, post-production background, and also the knowledge of how directors of photography would like cinematically. So my photographs, I think, began to take on a sort of a cinematic look,
right,
because of that background. And I always loved, right from the start, the look of 35mm motion picture film, how it could be manipulated, and, you know, how they would light certain scenes, and what a colorist could do to manipulate, you know, the blacks, and what he could do to change the colors and make it, you know, make it crunchy and poppier, and you just add so much texture. And that was such a formative time for me that it just stuck with my photography. Like it just transferred right over. And there's so much you can do with that type of lighting in photography, right? You know, you add rim lights and then, you know, butterfly lighting and key shifting and all this kind of stuff. So, and it's also why a lot of my stuff is on location, I think.
Now, explain that a little bit. You use a lot of artificial light, but you also enjoy being on location. Why is that?
Well, one of my favorite things to do is balance the sun against artificial light. So oftentimes, if you look at my images, I'm shooting right directly against the sun.
Okay.
So what I'll do is I'll just kind of get out on location. If it's like, you know, there's that one shot of the yoga girl that's on the railroad track.
Right.
And you can see the sun coming right through her toes.
That's awesome.
So with that, what I do is I kind of go out and I take a couple shots, or I don't really use a light meter anymore, but I'll go out and take a couple shots and I'll find the exposure that I like for the sun. And it's usually subject wise, you know, it'll be two or three stops underexposed where she's almost like a black silhouette. So then what I'll do is I'll just do a couple test shots where I match the artificial light source to balance, you know, so her face or her body is properly exposed, and then shoot against the sun. And then, you know, I throw in some rim lights, and I just find that what this does is that it creates a higher dynamic range image within a higher dynamic range within the image, as opposed to using post too much.
I see.
I still use quite a bit of post work, but most of those images that you see they're in camera. So that balance and that dynamic range, you know, where the sun is just, you know, it's like a little orb in the sky. The sky is very saturated and dark and blue, where the clouds are very dramatic, but the subject is lit against that. If I didn't use the light, either I'd have to make a decision that, you know, she would be exposed properly, but the whole sky would be, you know, blown out behind her.
Right.
Or that she'd just be a black silhouette, right? So it's like you're creating a higher dynamic range, actually. You're creating a frame with more information by balancing the light like that.
You find that you need a lot of power when you're in full sunlight like that? I mean,
yes.
You can't really get away with a couple of little small flashes, portable flashes as much, right?
No, I find you can't, unless you put them up really close, but then just going to sort of illuminate a part of the face. And you have to get up it's harder to shoot wide that way.
Okay.
Because you'll end up seeing the flash in the shot.
Right.
So I run a workshop called Big Lights Far Away for that reason, is that you need quite a bit of power, you know, because of things like, you know, the inverse square law, and like, light drops off really fast, right?
Right.
So you need to have that. If you want to move those lights further back, you need to have a lot of power, because that light is going to fall off exponentially as it reaches the subject. I'm usually shooting at, you know, when I'm shooting against the sun like that, it's not unusual to be at, you know, 100 ISO, at a 250, at 16 or 18,
wow,
or even sometimes 22.
That's,
you know, when you're shooting
awesome
right into the sun like that. So, you know, I'll use a 7B pack and just have to crank it. So I'm just, you know, a full, whatever, 1200 watt seconds, or if I'm using a generator with a 7A pack, then sometimes even like, you know, 2400 watt seconds with the softbox far. If I wanted a nice soft light, you know, so I'm using a large softbox, sometimes I use like a 6 foot softbox, but I'll have to put it like, you know, 10 feet away, 6 feet, if I'm shooting wider.
Wow.
You're going to need like 2400 watt seconds of power to get that soft wraparound light.
That's amazing.
I tend to use a lot of soft boxes because I like the light quality. I like the light quality of a large light. You know, light quality is determined by the size of the light source in relation to the subject. So the larger the light source, the larger the soft box, the more kind of a wraparound light you'll get. And the smaller the light source, you'll get like harder shadows. That's why if you hold up like one of the little hot shoe flashes up to somebody's face, then you'll get pretty harsh shadows on the other side.
Right.
Because the light source is so small in relation to them. So it creates more acute transfer areas in the shadows. Whereas I really like that wraparound natural kind of light, which a softbox or, you know, octobox can provide. Because that is so large and the light's so diffused, and I need to put it far away, relatively far away, I need a lot of power. It involves me carrying around generators, and, you know, I use the Honda 3000 generator. There's actually a YouTube clip where I'm shooting a band called Delirium, where I show the equipment I'm using. I have two 600 watt second rim lights, mono heads, and then as to the main light, I had a 7B pack, or a 7A pack hooked up to a generator. I can't remember, but yeah, usually lots of power.
So you can hear the cracks of the lights when they go off at 1200 watts.
It's you know, especially with pro photos, is that very definitive popping sound that they make, which is a beautiful sound.
It is.
I just think it's a really cool way to light, because, you know, the human eye would never see an image that way. I think that's what people look at and go, wow, that's really surreal or kind of cool or dramatic, because you know, it's very rare that the human eye would see an object lit like that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what makes it.
Or a subject lit like that.
Right. I have two questions as a follow-up to that. One is, when you location scout, what kind of things do you look for? Because by now, I'm sure you have favorite angles with the sun, yeah, and favorite skies and backgrounds and stuff. What gets you excited?
The first thing I sort of look at when location scouting is the percentage chance that I'll be booted out of that location.
Right.
Police or anybody else, which has happened on.
You want that high or low?
I prefer that not to happen. If I'm shooting with clients and it's an important job, then I'll make sure that everything is location permitted. My initial thought was, you know, if I just go and shooting some friends or doing some fun stuff, like kind of guerrilla stuff. That's one of the important things I look at is, you know, is there power there? Is there going to be any troubles if I don't have a location permit? Can I get out of here quickly?
Right.
Or if I do really like the location, then, you know, like get whoever I need to telephone number and get my location manager to call them and say, hey, can we shoot here? How much is it going to cost? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Power, I look at for sure. You know, you got to look at stuff like parking and whatnot. I mean, these are logistic things. As far as creative things, I kind of look at the texture. If it's a building or a warehouse, you know, is there some cool texture that we can play with? If it's out more in the open, I look at the horizon line. You know, are there weird trees popping up? Are there telephone poles and wires that are going to be kind of annoying? I'm going to have to Photoshop out stuff like that. Other than that, I just kind of look at a location and I'll sort in my mind and I'll, you know, think, you know, that'd be great to shoot this CEO here, you know, amongst this, because he's a really clean cut guy and here's kind of a cluttered background, or, you know, a musician, or so I kind of store things away like that. And, you know, I haven't yet, but I can't wait to get out with some lights and shoot some of Bombay, because this city is just incredible for shooting. And all the shoot I've been doing is just natural light. So I can't wait to actually get out and do some big light stuff.
Well, I definitely want to come back to that in a few minutes, because even your natural light images look very dramatic, very cinematic. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how you pull that off with natural light.
Sure.
But before that, do you have like a particular time of day that you try to target for these types of images when you have your lighting equipment with you?
Yeah, here's another thing that's different, actually, that I found that was interesting, is that in Vancouver, we're quite far from the equator, so that the sun tends to have this arc, which is really good for shooting, where if I'm down low and I'm shooting somebody from below facing up, I can usually get the sun to be right behind their head and create like a halo effect. So I find Vancouver was really good for that. Here in India, in Bombay, I'm finding, because it's a little closer to the equator, I'm finding that, you know, at 12 noon, I don't have a shadow.
Oh, wow.
Like, literally, the sun is so directly above me. So it would be a little bit harder to shoot against the sun around that time. But as the sun sets and as it comes up, then I think would be, like right now, it's about 8:30 and the sun is sort of in the perfect spot. So I think I would have to shoot either earlier or later here.
Okay.
If I want to get the sun in the shot. But I think there's so many other cool things to shoot here other than the sun that
right.
might not matter. But there are certain challenges with shooting natural light here in the daytime, because the sun is so much more overhead that it can create some pretty crazy shadows on people's faces. So I always, whenever I'm shooting natural light, I really try to get into the shadow, where if I find some nice diffused light, I rarely shoot natural in the sun anyway, unless I'm doing some overexposed backlit stuff. I don't really like a lot of shadows on the face.
So you find your even light, and there's still, to me, there's still a very dramatic feel to many of your images in your portfolio. Is that because of the post-processing?
Most of the images in my portfolio are lit with off-camera lighting. I think the only ones that I have that are not are on my blog.
Yeah, but even they look like there's high contrast, there's a lot of intensity, the colors are...
Yeah, so I'll use things like, you know, if I'm doing some assignment work for a magazine or whatnot, then, you know, as far as the photojournalistic style, then you want to kind of minimize any sort of Photoshop work. But if I'm doing something for my own personal thing, like all the shots on my blog are pretty much for personal use, and maybe for a book that I might put together, then I'll do some dodging and burning. I really like the colors here, like the women wear these beautiful colors. And that's another great contrast here. You just see a woman walking down the street and she'd be wearing this gold and red sari with this background of just dilapidated slum area. It's like, yeah, it's just fascinating. And she'll manage to keep that dress really clean. So just, you know, maybe bringing out some of the colors and the gold in the dress and then adding a little bit of color. You add a lot of contrast through dodging and burning and through things like, you know, adding clarity. You use a little clarity slider in Lightroom. I use a combination of Lightroom and Photoshop. So I'll do all my workflow in Lightroom. And then if I have an image that I want to work a little bit more on, I'll use Photoshop. So I'm finding that with Lightroom 2.0, there's a lot you can do in Lightroom 2.0 to really improve your images. They've added some functionality that I really like.
Excellent.
I guess I'm an Adobe guy.
Right.
So
it's hard not to be.
But yeah, so there's some dodging and burning and just trying to do what's best for the image, really. What can enhance the image, maybe pop it out. Because I find that the human eye sees so much contrast and it can see so much. The human eye has such a huge dynamic range. Like, I think the human eye can see 100 stops or something like that. I've heard of it. So actually, by doing a little bit of post work, I find that you're making the image look a little bit closer to what a human eye would see. I try to make my images closer to how my eye would see it, you know, so bring out a little bit of detail in the shadow and whatnot, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. You really do some amazing stuff when you do that. These shots are great.
Thanks, guys.
Let's talk for a minute about your workshops. When's the last one that
you did? I've done two.
Okay.
And I'm not quite sure what destiny holds for me here yet. So I'm not quite sure how long I'm going to be here. But I would love to do another workshop. And the workshops are basically, they're over a weekend. So I'll do like a lecture on a Friday night. I basically go through my entire portfolio and I describe exactly how I've lit everything.
Oh, that's cool.
Where I'm putting the lights. Yeah. So I'll describe all that. And then what I'll usually do is for the Saturday and Sunday, I try to do at least 3 or 4 setups. So we'll have a fashion shoot, and we'll have maybe shooting a mock band shot for a magazine or for a record label. And then I'll try to do an editorial shot, and then I'll try to do like a sports shot type thing. You know, so like I'm sort of a mock sort of like, yeah, we did one in September in Toronto where we shot some Olympic hopefuls in a track. And I think I put that up on my website. So, you know, like rim lighting and then key shifting down the ambient in the track and kind of giving a really hyper surreal look. So definitely with whatever, we definitely do use lots of lighting here.
Right.
So I think in my first workshop, we had about 80,000 watt seconds of power or something ridiculous.
Wow.
And I was just like, I was like, you guys, I want you to use all of this. Even if it looks terrible, just use it. So you learn how to use this lighting equipment because it's going to really enhance, you know, and then, you know, you learn how to use it because there's a lot of fear around it. You know, there's a lot of fear about taking a generator or a 7B pack and boom and all these lights. There's a lot of, you know, how do I do, what's my sync speed? What do I got to shoot at? How do all these settings work? So I just throw them into it. I'm like, just shoot, you know, learn the settings, you know, make mistakes, do it now because you don't want to do it on a real job. So I've spoken to some of the students afterwards and, you know, they've been out renting the gear. They've been out renting the profile gear and they're just loving it and their work's improving. And it just adds a whole new dimension to the photography. And it puts you up on a more pro level, I think.
Now, real quick, as you're saying about, you know, you have people use the stuff and shoot it as basically work it pretty hard. Are those some of the things that you do to help people develop more of a cinematic look, or what advice do you give to people to try and pull that kind of feeling out in your images?
The first thing I sort of mentioned to people is that, you know, I'm not doing this workshop so that anybody can go out and sort of emulate or copy my style. I mean, that's not the point. I mean, they can if they want. I mean, I don't think there's any rules that way, but I use it more as a bridge to more professional style of shooting where they can learn to develop their own style from there using these lights. You know, maybe, for example, they'll develop a style where they want to use powerful lights but not use soft boxes. They want to use, you know, their head reflectors, or they want to have a sharper image, you know, to the shadow, or sharper edge to the shadow, or that kind of thing. So I don't really particularly try to teach them any type of style. I just teach them what you can do with this type of equipment and how it works in relation to the sun and the ambient light and some of the logistics with carrying this kind of equipment around that you face. So it's a bit more of a crash course in using the light as opposed to developing, you know, a Martin Perota style of lighting, because I think that style has to evolve from their own personality and from your own experiences in life. I mean, photography is really just an expression of where you're at in your life, right? Everybody's images are going to look different from everybody else's, depending on where you decide to put the light, what kind of lighting style you do like, how you interact with models, what type of models you use, how you direct them. There's so much that goes into it, right? What kind of locations you choose. There's the technical aspect of photography, there's the equipment you use, and then there's the whole spiritual aspect to it, where it's like this is your expression of your own spirit and your own soul coming out into the work. You know, if anything, you know, I'd like to help people and get in touch with that part of themselves, that spirit side that will help create the great images, that will help understand the conflict, that kind of thing. The technical is just simply a tool, you know?
Right.
Sure.
You mentioned that you like to help photographers learn how to tell their story. And that's really interesting to me. You have a section on your website too called Why, and you talk a little bit about some of that. And there's a piece about meditation and so forth. Let's say someone who is just getting into photography and they're just kind of overwhelmed with all the different styles that are out there and things that are appealing to them. If you could say in a couple of sentences how to help someone try to seek their style and their voice, what would you tell them to start with?
I would definitely tell them that nothing will do more for their photography than just to go out and shoot and to see how that style is going to develop. And I would also say to them that, you know, although we all admire different photographers and different styles, we want to be aware as well that comparison is the thief of joy. Once you start comparing yourself or start creating sort of a hierarchical status where, you know, this photographer's way up here and I'm just down here and I'll never make it that far, I think those sort of things can be very self-defeating. And part of the reason why I like the yogic philosophy and meditation is that what you begin to realize is that we all have this seed of genius within us. We're all talented. We all have this incredible potential within us to share. So it's really just about being gentle with yourself. And this is something I've had to learn over the last few years, because I think 10, 15 years ago when I was starting out, I would be definitely not as gentle with myself as I am now, as far as being an artist. You know, I think there's a lot of things you can do and say to yourself that are detrimental to your own growth. I know this is a very long, convoluted way of saying this, but be gentle with yourself as you're starting out. Enjoy your process. It's about the journey, not the destination. You know, there's nowhere to really reach. There's just this organic, evolutionary impulse that we all have to progress and to get better and to learn about the world and learn about ourselves. So just enjoy that journey and keep shooting and seeing what happens and just start to figure out those magic moments. There's these aha moments that happen in photography. There's this interesting book. It's called The Path to Mastery. I forget what the author's name, but what he talks about is he talks about the learning curve. And the interesting thing he says about the learning curve is that the learning curve isn't this gradual, smooth, sloping upward curve. The learning curve is a series of plateaus followed by humps, and then plateaus, and then humps. And then each time the plateau gets a little higher and a little higher. What he says is that a lot of times what happens is people reach the plateau and they figure that, you know, they've learned everything they can and that's it, and they kind of fizzle off. Whereas the truth is that within that plateau, within that point of your career, within that point of your photography where you feel that, you know, nothing is happening and that you're stagnant, within that are actually the germinating seeds of your next evolutionary step in your art form.
Oh, that's cool. When you see yourself beginning to be frustrated about where you are and where you've been for a while, that's a good opportunity then to challenge yourself and find some new place to go then with it.
Exactly. And it's another sort of reason why I decided to switch things up and come here. I was doing a certain type of work in Vancouver. I loved the work I was doing. And I had a steady client base. And I was just like, you know, like, what can I do that's a little bit different? What can I do to grow? And so I came here and here I am, you know, like I'm hitting the pavement and I'm talking to agencies, you know, the way I was sort of years ago when I was starting off back home. It's such a humbling and beautiful thing, because I think photography has this amazing ability that when you think you've reached a certain point, you're like, you know, you're sitting pretty on a little photographic pedestal. This art has an incredible way of turning around, kicking you in the ass and making you humble.
Right.
as does any art, I think. And that's, so I'm enjoying this process right now, because it's just me and my camera, you know, right now. It's like, I'm not doing any of the big light stuff yet here.
Right.
I'm making the connections. And I'm also actually exploring getting back into directing commercials and directing films. And I've just finished the first draft of a feature film here. So I'm very excited about that. Just always try to keep, you know, reinventing yourself. Always, when things get a little cozy and comfortable, then, you know, try to switch things up a little bit the best you can. And just keep shooting and really pay attention to those aha moments.
That's great advice.
Cool.
You said something just there that was kind of interesting to me too, and kind of a timely opportunity to ask a question about this. You have a background in the moving image, and you've been translating a lot of what you know into still photography for quite some time. How do you feel about the sort of melding that we're starting to see of the motion image and the still photography, like with DSLRs gaining video capabilities and so forth?
I think it's fantastic. And I think it's been a long time coming in some way. I mean, I shoot with the Mark II, the 5D Mark II, and I'm out shooting video with that camera as much as I am shooting still. And, you know, then I get home and, you know, because I have experience editing, I kind of load it all into Final Cut and I cut together, you know, little video blogs and whatnot. So I think as far as creating, as a photographer, creating, you know, is a bit of a niche market for yourself too, in that you can, you know, especially if you're working with NGOs and if you're doing that sort of photojournalistic work, to be able to say to your client, you know, I can see the stills of your project or whatever relief program is going on, but at the same time, I can also, you know, plug in a little microphone here and I can do an interview with some of your subjects. I can go home and edit it. And if I can find an online connection, I can have that up and posted to your site, the photos and the video, the next day. I think that's great for people like NGOs, great for charities that are always looking for donors, because it helps with their fundraising. Because now they don't have to pay a videographer and they don't have to pay a photographer separately. You can go out and shoot the video and the skills, you know, you can edit the video. And then you can have this, it just creates a bigger pack. You can put out a bigger package. It's value added for your client, basically, right?
Right. Well, one of the things that Ed and I were talking about last evening was when it comes to lighting, like, especially in your case where you've got a large investment or at least a large rental investment in strobe equipment. And then you say, you know what, this setting's amazing. I'm getting these awesome still images. I'd like to take like a 3-minute moving image. And then what do you do? I mean, is that an issue at all for you?
You mean sort of taking a moving image in the same sort of style?
Yeah, would you ever would you find yourself wanting to do that, or you still don't view video in the same
way? No, like you could totally do that. You just, if you wanted to light it the same way, you'd have to pick up some hot lights. You'd have to pick up, you know, continuous lights.
Right, so you'd have to have a separate setup then.
You'd have to have a separate setup. set up, and you'd have to, you know, you'd have to gel them a little bit differently, right?
Right.
Because, you know, tungsten is. But actually, I haven't encountered that yet. That's something like, you know, that sort of be like a music video type feel, right? Where you're shooting a music video.
Sure,
or that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, you need a different setup. But, you know, when it comes down to it, and if you have a client and renting lights, people get kind of caught up in the cost of renting lights. But, you know, you can rent lights for pretty darn cheap, I think. To me, the cost of renting lights has never been, inhibitive.
Right.
Because the money I've been able to generate from that type of image has been much greater than if I had only been using natural light. So basically what I started doing was, when I first was getting to photography and digital and exploring the whole strobe light thing, what I would do is I'd use my own money and I'd spend $200 and I'd go rent a 7D pack for the weekend. Usually you can rent them on anywhere where I rent, you can rent them on a Friday night and return them Monday morning for one day rental rate.
Oh, nice.
So I would jam pack that weekend full of shoots. I'd have a shoot in the morning with some friends and a shoot in the evening, and then Sunday all day I'd be shooting and something different. So I'd have four set up and I'd have, you know, a 7D pack with a couple heads. I'd paper it all myself and I'd have all these images. And then within a weekend I'd have, you know, four really cool setups. And I'd do this for a few months to the point where now, you know, people were approaching me to shoot, but they didn't have a lot of money. So I'd say, you know what, just pay for the rental of the lights. And so now I was getting the rent to pay for. I was still working for free. Like, and then eventually that progressed for a few months. Photos got better. And then before I knew it, I was charging for the rental lights and my time.
Very cool.
So it's kind of what you have to do. You got to kind of take a hit at first, right? But it's like any business. You have to make that capital investment, I think.
Excellent.
Sure. You're investing in your future.
Yeah. And I mean, my paid off. It's paid off huge. I, you know, I've paid all my camera gear off. I sold my lights and my photo gear when I came here. So somebody else out there making brilliant images, I'm sure.
That's great.
It was hard because I sold my mono heads and I sold my boom, and it was tough. It was like saying goodbye. It was like sending a kid off to college. I don't know. I found that I was renting all my gear anyway. So
that's amazing.
But I've had a good time. Just me and my 5D, and just me and the Mark II, and I have a 24 to 72.8. I just walk around town in this crazy city.
Nice.
I've got some very good shoots coming up. I just had some meetings with some advertising agencies. So
excellent.
And also, you know, for directing commercials and whatnot as well.
We'll be keeping an eye on your website and your portfolio for sure. We've been having folks give us questions throughout the day on Twitter, actually, to ask you. There's a couple of funny ones, but sure. Several people have mentioned that they would really like to encourage you to continue to put stuff up on YouTube. That's been a tremendous help to a lot of people. So thank you for that.
Okay.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've done on YouTube so that we can encourage people to go check that out? What's with the monkey?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you know, the stuff I've put up on YouTube has been pretty ridiculous. So I'm surprised that it gets the attention that it does. But I think that the main thing that people get out of those YouTube videos is that I have a lot of fun on my shoots. And, you know, one thing I really try to do is really engage and work with my talent a lot. And again, I think that comes from my strong desire to be a director and to direct, is that a lot of my photographs, I think, have a sort of a directed feel. You know, you can tell that maybe the actors or that whoever has been directed to be a certain way. So I hope that comes across in the images, in the videos as well. And then, of course, I just try to go through my lighting. There's a couple silly ones I put up that are kind of silly, but there's two, which is, one is my Big Lights Far Away video, which I think is great in the fact that you can see a little bit about what the course is accomplishing. And also I do a pan of all the equipment I'm using. So if you can kind of slow it down, it's about halfway through. I basically show all the equipment we're using, like, you know, the pack. So it's a good reference. And with the Delirium shoot, I actually go through how I'm using it and why, you know, I'm putting up flags for the rim lights. So it cuts down flare, and, you know, I'm using a beauty dish, and this is how this is working. So
that's awesome.
I absolutely have no problem sharing any knowledge or information. Yeah.
Well, people appreciate it. I appreciate it too. Thanks for doing that. Another interesting question we got. This gentleman said, I've always been curious about what the Atomic Safari thing means in the URL of your blog.
Oh, it was my email address for a while, but it came to me in a dream, just that name. And I always thought I would use that name for something, for a company or a production company. And
that's cool.
I just, again, it's a juxtaposition of it. I think it paints a great sort of image in the mind, Atomic Safari.
That's awesome.
I don't know. I just have this jungle blowing up or something like that. I don't know. I sometimes have a hard time grabbing how things come to me. You know, people ask me specific questions, but it's just like things are always popping in and out of my head. And then, you know, where I get some of the ideas from my shots, I don't know where they come from.
Throughout the day, if these things are popping into your mind, are you capturing them somehow? Do you have a sketchbook, anything like that?
Yeah, I keep a journal, and I don't have a sketchbook because I'm a horrible drawer. I can't draw. Kendra. I have a business partner that runs my production company with me back home, and his name is Bill, and he's a storyboard artist. So he's, for any of the commercial stuff that we've done, he's always done the storyboarding. I storyboard quite a few of my shots at their agency jobs as well.
Awesome.
I find that it's very helpful just to storyboard, and I'm just terrible. I draw stick characters. So
do you take those storyboards to your clients too then, or is that mostly for your reference?
I'll take them to the clients. Yeah. Cool.
Excellent.
If it's a concept that, you know, requires a bit of explanation, I just find that, you know, in that case, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
That's excellent. Okay, last question. And this is actually from another audience member. It says, ask Martin how much product he needs to use to get his hair to do that.
to that one. Probably about a dime's worth of wax or whatever. but that's actually, awesome. It's so freaking hot here. I'm actually going to shave my head, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's literally like, I think it's getting upwards to 40 degrees.
Oh, man.
I'm sweating right now.
That's Celsius. So for us Americans, we...
Oh, yeah, that's centigrade. Sorry, yeah, that's centigrade. 40 degrees centigrade. Yeah. So, I don't know. It's got to be close to 100 degrees.
Wow.
Or something.
Wow. Well, a serious parting question, though. If you had one piece of advice to give someone who wanted to get into the commercial photography industry, what would you tell them?
I would say make friends with art directors and copywriters at agencies. Go to them and say, hey, I'm starting out. Do you guys have any cool concepts that you've written for clients that maybe the clients didn't have the money for or the clients rejected, or any kind of cool concepts that have been playing around in your head? And they might say, yeah, actually, we have something that we've been working on. It's kind of funny. We can't find a client for it. But yeah, if you want to go and shoot it, then I would do the best you can to shoot that and develop your relationships with advertising agencies that way.
That's great advice.
That is a good
idea. Yeah, that's really good advice. And that's how actually I've done a lot of my stuff. You know, I was talking to ad agencies and saying, hey, do you guys have any ideas? And just always keeping in touch and saying, a lot of people's approach is, you know, hey, my name's so-and-so and, you know, I want to work with you guys.
Right.
And they're like, okay, well, that's cool. So do a lot of people. But you can go and say, hey, my name's Martin and I really like the work you guys do. And I know that you put out a lot of stuff that maybe clients didn't want or whatever. Do you have anything that you would love to see shot for your portfolio as an art director or as a copywriter, and that I can use it? And they're usually like, well, actually, yeah, let me get back to you on that. And then, you know, they'd call me back and say, yeah, we got this one idea, or this guy's doing this and it's for this product. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, we'll need this for that, we'll need that location for that. And you go and shoot it, and bang, you've got like not only a relationship with that agency, but you've got something for your own portfolio.
That's very cool. So,
that's a brilliant idea.
Very nice.
Yeah. And it's very non-invasive to them, right? Because they get calls from photographers all the time saying, hey, this is me, this is my stuff, take a look at it. But, you know, just give you an approach and say, hey, I want to shoot one of your guys' ideas.
Absolutely.
And then you try to do the best job you can, do a bang-up job. And then they're like, well, hey, that guy, you know, he did this. And then that's a great way to build relationships.
Very nice. Very cool. Thank you for everything that you give back to the photography community and for spending an hour with us in your morning there in Bombay. I really appreciate talking with you tonight.
I appreciate you guys calling, and I'm always open to questions. So if you want to give out my email address, I absolutely don't mind. Spend a couple hours a week trying to answer people's questions the best I can.
That's excellent.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Well, that's all we have for this episode of Light Source,
the brightest podcast on the internet.
Be sure to check out the show notes for this episode and all the other Light Source episodes at the website studiolighting.net.
And you can also send us an email comment at studiolighting@gmail.com when you can send us comments, questions, or just images that you'd like us to see.
And if you really want to get involved with some of the other listeners to the show, you can head over to the Light Source Flickr group at www.flickr.com/groups/lightsource. You can post your images and get feedback on your photography, as well as seeing the things that we're taking pictures of.
And as always, if you missed any of these links, our quick outro here, you can find all of that and more at www.studiolighting.net.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Check out this show and more great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.